Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan's special envoy says General Burhan is committed to restoring peace and security across the country, but with one condition.
If this rebellion put down arms, we will pardon them. Not only pardon them, we will be ready to reintegrate whoever is interested to be part and parcel of the Sudanese army.
Meanwhile, Sudanese citizens are cautiously optimistic about the ongoing peace talks in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. We'll speak with an official of the International Committee of the Red Cross about the plight of civilians in Khartoum. Zimbabwe's Constitutional Court rejects an opposition request to postpone this year's elections. And Nigeria's Election Tribunal begins hearing petitions challenging the outcome of the February 25 presidential election.
The principle of law is that he who has sat must prove and establish the facts contained therein. That if he is not able to establish the fact containing his assertion, then he will not be able to enjoy any judgment of the court.
And Zimbabwe Appeals Court acquits writer and filmmaker C.C. Dangarimba of incitement and violence. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan's special envoy says his government is committed to restoring peace and security across the country. Ali Dafala met with South Sudan President Salva Kiir in Juba on Monday. The country's acting foreign affairs minister says President Kiir considers the violence a Sudanese conflict that only requires an internal solution. For VOA News, Mayanga David Maya reports from Juba.
In speaking to reporters shortly after a closed-door meeting with President Kiir, Dafala said the government in Khartoum is concerned about the protection and safety of civilians.
I would like to assure everybody that we are concerned with the situation of our civilians. We are concerned with their protection, with their safety. That is why the army didn't adopt severe measures to put an end to that conflict. Had we want to do that, the army has the ability to do it in a very short time. But the safety and protection of our civilians is a priority.
Delegations of Sudan Armed Forces and Rapid Support Forces began talks in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia on Friday to try to reach a ceasefire. Dafala says the Jeddah talks will only concentrate on the humanitarian aspect of the conflict. He says the conflict in Sudan will only be resolved when the paramilitary rapid support forces accept to lay down their weapons.
I will quote again what has been voiced by President Burhan when he said, if this rebellion put down arms, we will pardon them. Not only pardon them, we will be ready to reintegrate whoever is interested to be part and parcel of the Sudanese army. I don't think, you know, a legal president would start talks regarding the final settlement with the leader of a rebellion.
The Intergovernmental Authority on Development appointed President Kiir to lead regional efforts to help the warring parties to peacefully resolve their conflict. Deng Dao Ding, South Sudan's acting foreign affairs minister, says President Salva Kiir reiterated his position to Al-Burhan's special envoy during the meeting.
Our interest is the stability and peace in Sudan. And peace in Sudan is peace in South Sudan. His Excellency the President have conveyed this message to the special envoy, and he also asked him that he will continue to talk to President Burhan on the situation. The President shared with the special envoy our situation in 2013, the situation that happened here, the situation that happened in 2016, and how him, as the president of South Sudan, was able to reach out and was able to bring about peace that we are enjoying today. You compare this particular situation with what is happening in Sudan.
Deng says President Kiir has also warned some unnamed external actors against interfering in Sudan's conflict. The acting foreign minister says South Sudan has also extended an invitation for General Mohamed Abdan Daglo to send an envoy to Juba for more talks with President Salva Kiir. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayer in Juba.
Many in Sudan are cautiously optimistic about the Saudi and U.S. broker peace talks in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, between Sudan's warring generals amid reports of a pause in the fighting. But thousands are still trying to flee the country, and analysts are skeptical that any deal will bring long-term peace. In another development, U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Monday condemned the looting of the main World Food Program compound in Khartoum over the weekend. Michael Atit reports from Port Sudan.
The mediation talks continued for a third day Monday in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, with no word on whether the negotiations are making progress. Representatives of the military and the rapid support forces are invited to Jeddah to discuss a proposed ceasefire so humanitarian aid agencies can access people who are wounded, hungry, or displaced after more than 3 weeks of fighting. The Sudan Tribune reported Sunday that the army negotiators have made three demands, including unconditional withdrawal of the rapid support forces from the capital, Khartoum, an extension of the humanitarian truce, and the integration of the RSF into the Sudanese army within 2 years. The newspaper said it is not clear how the RSF negotiators will respond to these demands. A truce between the two sides remains officially in place, but eyewitnesses in Khartoum told VOA they heard renewed gunfire and an airstrike in the city Monday in and around the downtown area. Sudanese citizens are watching the talks in Jeddah with a mix of hope and skepticism. Sumaya Musa, who fled violence from Khartoum to Al Jazeera State, says she is optimistic that the ongoing talks in Jeddah will bear fruit so she can find a safe road to escape Sudan. She says, our hope for these talks is that the guns will be silenced and we move out of this country. Practically, we are suffering. We just want to see that airstrikes, bombing and guns to stop for a while. Another woman, Amira Saleh, arrived Port Sudan a week ago and is currently living in open area within the town. Saleh says she doubts if the warring parties are ready at the moment to stop hostilities. She says there is no consensus among them and they will not reach any agreement or at least a basis to draw a roadmap that can take these talks to a stage of negotiations. Sudanese writer Meki Al-Maghribi says majority of Sudanese citizens support the military and there is no way they would allow the rapid support forces to remain as a separate armed group. He says he believes the only solution at the moment for them is to get a safe road and leave the city.
I believe that granting rapid support forces safe passage or safe exit out of Khartoum could be a possible solution.
An Arab Foreign Ministers Summit held on Sunday in Cairo called for a complete ceasefire in Sudan. The meeting also formed a committee composed of Egypt and the Arab League to find a way to halt the fighting. The African Union urged in a statement the parties to the conflict to immediately cease fire for humanitarian reasons and urgently open humanitarian corridors. Michael Atit for VOA News, Port Sudan.
Yesterday, Monday, was World Red Cross and Red Crescent Day, which recognizes the life-saving work of the group's volunteers in conflict zones. The biggest hotspot for humanitarians in Africa now is Sudan, where fighting continues in the capital Khartoum between rival factions of the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces. James Reynolds is the International Committee of the Red Cross's Deputy Director of Operations for Africa. He tells viewers Caravan Dam that he is in touch with his colleagues every day in Khartoum amid bullets and shells.
All of the things that you and I would like to have in a city have stopped or are certainly under threat. Electricity, supplies of fuel, the banking system, availability of cash, and all the basic services that come with that. So, you know, you've got this, you know, enormous city where, I mean, our estimate is that 16% of the health structures are still functioning, very few schools. So that's taking an enormous toll on you know, people in Khartoum. We've also seen a sort of reignition of fighting in different parts of Darfur in the west of the country. So really a very, very tough situation.
How is it with your ICRC folks on the ground there? Has it gotten any better since April 15th, or are they able to get around any at all in the capital, elsewhere in the country?
I think we've still got some of our offices that are functioning more or less normally. Khartoum has been very, very challenging. What our teams have been able to do in Khartoum is distribute some medical supplies to medical teams in the city. It's a little, it's not as much as we'd like to do, and but it's a start, and we really need to kind of step that up. With volunteers and really brave people from the Sudanese Red Crescent, they've been, you know, moving around the city and doing everything they can to try to, well, what we call dead body management, and many, many people have been killed in the violence, and literally their bodies are, you know, lying around in the streets. So really kind of collecting that and trying to give a sort of modicum of a decent burial and dignity to that. We reach out to all of the different actors and play this role as a kind of neutral intermediary, trying to ensure that there is at least a little bit of a humanitarian space for people to move around. I think we're kind of enthused that there have, representatives of each side have been able to travel now to Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. There's been a little bit of a calm and a little bit less active combat, I think, in Khartoum. But it'd be really important that sort of calm, you know, deepens and consolidates over time, because until that happens, people are really going to be struggling.
Are there actual humanitarian corridors, you know, within Khartoum?
As I say, it's a large city. I mean, some parts of the city are much more affected than others. There are sort of, you know, multiple front lines, if you like, you know, controlled by one or other side. So, and it is still very much a kind of moving situation, I think. So it's still not an area where we or other humanitarian actors can work exactly in the way we would like to, you know, feeling secure and that, you know, the Red Cross or Red Crescent emblem is fully respected by everybody. So I think we've seen some progress, but it's still a long way to go. And I think really, really important that Sudan is a country with, you know, plenty of very, very qualified doctors and nurses, but they need to be respected and the medical mission really needs to be respected to enable them to kind of work and treat these, you know, these hundreds or even thousands of people who have been wounded without fearing for their own lives.
That was James Reynolds, Deputy Director of Africa for International Committee of the Red Cross. He was speaking with my colleague, Carrie Van Dam from Geneva, Switzerland. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 9th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. In Nigeria, an election tribunal has begun hearing petitions seeking to challenge the outcome of the February 25 presidential vote. But the political pressure group Concerned Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law says many people do not expect a positive outcome from the proceedings. Former Vice President Atiku Abubakar and former Anambra State Governor Peter Obi are each challenging the polls. They cite voter irregularities, rigging, and failure of the Independent National Electoral Commission, INEC, to comply with its own measures to ensure transparency during the vote. INEC has declared former Lagos State Governor and Chieftain of the ruling All Progressive Congress APC Party, Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu, winner of the presidential contest. VOA's Peter Clotty spoke with Deji Adeyanju, the convener for Concerned Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law.
Nigerians have given up on the judiciary and the country. There's no much expectation. Anybody telling you that Nigerians are expecting anything from the tribunal has been economical with the truth. And the expectation of our organization is that the main opposition candidate, which is Atiku Abubakar, that secured the prescribed minimum required votes at the election, that's the concluded presidential election, because he met the 25% into third of the states, that he should be able to prove before the presidential election tribunal passed that he indeed he secured the majority votes cast at that election. Because the principle of law is that he who has sat must prove and establish the facts contained therein. That if he is not able to establish the fact contained in his assertion, then he will not be able to enjoy any judgment of the court.
Peter Obi and the obedient are also believing that they won legitimately the election and that they were robbed of the victory. What is your take on that?
My take is that, you know, for you to lay claim to having won majority vote cast at least you must meet the threshold, the constitutional threshold of 25% in two-thirds states of the federation. So if you've not been able to meet that threshold, your petition at the tribunal would be frivolous, you know. So to think otherwise, or to think to the contrary, that you will secure a judgment in your favor when you have not even been able to meet the constitutional threshold, you know, that is indeed laughable. And that is why I do not see any merit in the Obi's petition. You know, it's just for he needs the petition to enjoy to continue to enjoy the media visibility and that he's currently enjoying. And if he had not filed a petition at the tribunal, is many of his supporters who are currently drunk, high on the obedience wine, will feel that he has compromised. So it is just a feel-good petition that he has filed at the tribunal. But in terms of whether the court will be persuaded by any petition, I think the Atiku's petition, you know, seems to carry more weight.
Why do you think many Nigerians or some Nigerians are saying they don't have confidence in the election tribunal?
Yes, thank God that your world reputable radio organization, Voice of America, can bear me witness and bear Nigerian witness that the quality of judgments that come out of the courts these days cannot be compared to the quality of judgments and the quality of the courts during the time of the Nikki Tobis of this world, the Caribbean Whites of this world, the Oputas of this world. If you look at the major albatross of the Nigerian judiciary today is the Imo case, where someone who came a distant fourth, you know, performed judicial magic and became the winner of an election. So the judiciary they have only themselves to blame.
Some people are worried that the election tribunal may not be able to conclude and make a ruling on the challenge of the outcome of the election in time for the swearing-in of Bola Ahmed Tinubu, otherwise known as the Jagaban, who was declared by INEC as the winner of the February 25th presidential election.
Well, it's very simple. The constitution is clear on issue of term limit. May 29th is sacrosanct. Whether the petitions are concluded or not, a new president has to be sworn in. Not one day can be added the tenure of Buhari and the Buhari regime. So Tinubu must be sworn in on May 29th, whether the petitions are concluded or not.
Deji Adeyanju is the convener for Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty from Abuja, Nigeria. In Zimbabwe, the leader of the opposition movement for democratic change, MDC, says the country's constitutional court is playing politics with important electoral issues. Zimbabwe is supposed to have elections in July or August this year. The MDC had asked the court to postpone the election because it said the Electoral Commission's constituency boundary report did not take into consideration the results of last year's census, which have yet to be published. But the court said the parties application did not discuss the cost of postponement. MDC leader Douglas Munzora tells me the court ruling is politically motivated and that the party plans to petition the Supreme Court today, Tuesday. He also said the MDC plans to take its complaint to the Southern African Development Community, SADC.
Today, the Constitutional Court dismissed our application on a technicality, and the technicality does not make sense to us. So in our view, the court has taken a political rather than a legal route. And we are not very happy with their ruling, which basically dismisses the application. However, we do have a chance of refiling this case in the High Court, and we are going to do that tomorrow. This delimitation report is bad. This delimitation report has the potential of being used to steal elections, and we are determined to fight this delimitation report.
So I'd like for you to, for the purpose of our listeners, why did you file your application with the court? Why?
We filed because in terms of our constitution, before delimitation is done, the population must be known. Zimbabwe had a population census last year, but the results of that census are not yet out. So it was done without regard to the issue of population. That's a fundamental problem, number one. Number two is that the constitution says that there must be equality in the numbers in each constituency or ward. And if there is to be any difference, it must not exceed 20%. However, in 119 out of 210, that rule is violated. And we have so much discrepancy among the wards and the constituencies. And then the demarcation of the country into the constituencies was done in terms of certain codes. But if you put these codes in a computer, they are giving us land which is outside Zimbabwe. So this is an incompetently done thing, or if it was done deliberately, it was in order to steal the elections. And it is fundamental. We cannot allow the country to go to elections with this type of delimitation report.
Would the opposition be ready, therefore, for the election?
It is very difficult to go to elections under this delimitation report. But if this delimitation report is rectified, then yes, we can go to elections. But it is very difficult to go to elections with a report like that, that is going to be used for elections. So we need to fight, we need to struggle to make sure that we put things right. We are prepared as the MDC to approach SADC. In fact, I think tomorrow we will do a letter to the heads of state of SADC, Southern African Development Community, protest about what Zimbabwe is doing. Our worry is that what the Supreme Court has done reduces Zimbabwe into an international laughingstock. We are determined to put things right.
Thank you so much again. A pleasure speaking with you, Mr. Wanzora.
Thank you so much, sir.
Douglas Wanzora is the leader of the Opposition Movement for Democratic Change, MDC, in Zimbabwe. He was speaking with me from the capital, Harare. A Zimbabwe appeals court on Monday acquitted writer and filmmaker Sisi Dangarembga. A Harare magistrate court found her guilty in 2020 for holding up a sign demanding institutional reform. The government said then that she was demonstrating without permission with the intention to incite violence. The court also fined Sisi about $200 and gave her a 6-month suspended sentence on condition she does not commit a similar offense. Sisi's lawyer, Harrison Nkomo, tells me that Sisi should never have been convicted in the first place because she did not commit a crime.
It is a correct ruling. In fact, we should not have even gone all the way from the Magistrates Court to the High Court. They should have not been arrested in the first place. But let's give the police the benefit of doubt that they made a mistake of arresting them thinking that they committed an offense. There was an opportunity to correct that mistake by the police at Magistrates Court level. But the Magistrates Court completely missed the issue that was before them. And certainly it had to go again on appeal before the judges, and the judges are the ones who actually realized that no. Tiki and their colleagues did not commit any offense at law, and resultantly proceeded to acquit them this afternoon.
What does this case say about the whole idea of freedom of speech in Zimbabwe?
It's a two-way thing. I must say the constitution in this country substantially guarantees freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, association, artistic humor and everything. That's the constitution. What is lacking is proper recognition of people's rights in terms of the constitution. In fact, the administrative authorities are reluctant to allow people to enjoy their rights as enshrined in the constitution. But the constitution itself is very, as far as I'm concerned, is actually very watertight. It's only the attitude and lack of political will to observe people's rights.
Of course, the government said then that she was demonstrating without permission.
You don't require permission to demonstrate, number one. Clearly, also, the government was not telling the truth. If she was not facing a charge of demonstration, she was facing a charge of participating in a gathering for the purposes of causing bigotry, incitement to commit public violence, and the like. So a suggestion that she was charged with incitement is incorrect.
She was fined at the time of the first ruling. She was fined, I think it was $200. What happened?
She definitely has to get it back because we are going back to the status that she was in before arrest.
So she will get her money back?
She get the fine, the money that she paid, yes, she'll get it back.
So where is Sisi herself? Is she in Zimbabwe?
No, she's out of the country.
It's a pleasure speaking with you. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much, James. Have a good day.
Harrison Nkomo is the lawyer for Zimbabwe writer and filmmaker Sisi Dangarembga. He was speaking with me from the Zimbabwe capital, Harare. And that's it for this Tuesday, May 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing